Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. I'm running for Congress in the 1st District of New York, but I'm a longtime journalist and author, and I'm focused on how to solve the problems we face rather than fixating on our problems, which we spend too much time doing as a country. So this podcast is all about solutions, and today we're going to dig into one of the biggest issues of this election and our time, the issue of border security and how it fits into a larger program of immigration reform, something we can fix if we work together. And I'm joined by the legendary Linda Chavez. Now, Linda is a well-known author and commentator. I'm sure you've heard and seen her over the years. She also began her career at the AFT with Al Shanker and then became the highest-ranking woman in the Reagan White House and the first Latina nominated to serve in a U.S. cabinet. Linda has been part of these debates and the search for solutions for a long time, and it's an honor to welcome her here. Linda, great talking with you.
Great to be with you, John.
So, Linda, you have the benefit of enormous perspective. We passed an immigration reform in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, but obviously it was not a panacea. And now this is an issue which is deeply divisive. It feels incredibly urgent. We had a border security solution that seemed like it was going to go forward, but then failed when Donald Trump pulled the plug. Talk about the state of our border right now from your perspective.
Well, it is much better than it was a year ago. I can say that. There's been a precipitous decline in the number of border encounters at our southern border. We had among the highest levels of illegal crossings in our history last year. And I think the Biden administration, once the border bill did not pass, the bipartisan bill that was a very tough bill and I think would have made a lot of improvements, they began doing things that perhaps they should have done earlier to help stem the flow, including working with Mexico, getting Mexico involved, because obviously our border is with Mexico, and no matter where people are coming from, they have to travel through Mexico to get to the United States. And so getting Mexico to do a better job of enforcing its own borders and to help turn people away at the U.S. border has, in fact, been very important. And we've seen a big decline, as I said. It's really quite amazing that we've gone from having, 2 million people to now a matter of a few hundred thousand people who are coming through. Doesn't sound great. I know there are a lot of people out there who'd like to believe that they could somehow stop all illegal immigration. But frankly, that's not really possible.
Why?
Well, because the people who are coming to the United States are coming here not just because they're fleeing oppression or they're fleeing, bad economies in their native countries, although that's a huge part of it. They're coming here because we have work that needs to be done. And they are fairly confident that if they manage to get into the United States, they will, in fact, find a job. And that job will present a better life for them than they were able to have in their home countries. And it's part of the whole law of supply and demand. We are in short supply of workers in the United States. And there are a lot of people out there who are willing to do these jobs. And my point has always been that you can build a wall, you can come up with more sophisticated ways to track people crossing our border. But at the end of the day, if you don't give people a chance to come to the United States legally and to work legally in the United States, you're not going to be able to solve the problem.
This goes back to sort of a core common sense belief I have. I'm the grandson of immigrants. It's what makes me so patriotic. And that's a not uncommon experience. You are, we should say, Mexican-American, but your family's been in North America for hundreds of years,
yes.
Much longer than mine by a lot.
1601.
I mean, that's just mind-boggling. And it's one of those facts that's important to mention because it disrupts the stereotypes that people have sometime around our politics and immigration. But there is a concern that this is an issue of fairness, that we have a broken system. And to your point, though, comprehensive immigration reform would help deal with the immigration side, presumably the Dreamers, and then the border security. To me, We need more legal immigration and less illegal immigration. And that shouldn't be controversial, but those two things need to move in tandem. Why has comprehensive immigration reform, which was proposed by President George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden, failed to get traction when everybody knows that's the real disruption of the status quo we need to solve this problem?
You know, I was very disappointed during the Obama administration when President Obama had both a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House that he did not push through immigration reform. That would have been the time to do it. And I think it could have been accomplished, but he didn't. He was concentrating on health care and his priorities were elsewhere. I also think that he comes from a part of the country that has traditionally not had a lot of immigrants, at least not since the early 20th century coming, and that's, you know, Illinois and Chicago area. And so he was not as really attuned to the issue as George W. Bush was, or Ronald Reagan was, both of them having been governors of border states. So we didn't get it done then. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been talking about this issue for decades, literally, and going out and speaking to Republican groups. And invariably, people tell me it isn't that we're anti-immigrant, we're anti-illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. You know, what I always try to explain is you can't solve the illegal immigration problem without giving people a way to come legally. And I think, you know, when you go through the numbers, when you explain that really just to keep up with both our labor needs and the fact that we have an aging population, we need about 1.3 million new immigrants every year. Now, if you did it legally, you could place a priority on the kind of people that you wanted. We already give H-1B visas to people who have special skills, and that's popular in a lot of places, a little less popular in some places. But we need more people who just do ordinary jobs that, frankly, Americans shun. Working on poultry processing lines, picking our fruits and vegetables, helping clean our businesses. And those kinds of skills are also skills that we need. So we need to come up with a system that balances both the high-end skills, the people who've got math and engineering degrees, and the people who do jobs that, frankly, Americans are too educated to do. Americans, you know, we have an average education level of over 13 years. A third or so of our population has college degrees. You're not going to entice somebody to go work on a poultry processing line if they have other options. And yet, if we don't do those jobs here, the only other alternative is to ship those jobs abroad. And we know that even among Democrats, people are not happy about jobs going overseas. So it's not that difficult a problem, but there is a lack of political will. And that's what's held it up.
And yet at such cost. I mean, I deeply believe that immigration is America's greatest renewable resource. You know, history is pretty clear about that. When you look at the benefits of immigrants and immigrant families to our country, from starting more new businesses to Nobel Prizes, I mean, you could go on and on. But you're talking about a basic practicality that I hear when I talk to farmers here in Suffolk County out of the North Fork. I mean, you know, temporary worker visas, if the system worked, would be the way to handle this. But then you have the danger of unscrupulous companies hiring undocumented workers and undercutting American workers in issues like construction. So it does seem that the economic piece of this, which can be solved if we have more legal immigration and less illegal, that's a win-win. If every foreign student who gets a PhD in the United States, that diploma should have a green card stapled to it. We don't want that you know, IP, as it were, you know, to go overseas. We want to keep that innovation energy here. But it does come down to frustration around the border. And when the governors of Texas and Florida shipped migrants up to New York, it kicked off a political firestorm because of the costs, because of frustration, understandably, with the absurd situation with asylum, where people declare economic asylum at the border. And asylum is, you know, its original intent was political persecution, fear of life. Declare economic asylum, and then it takes 4 years to adjudicate the claims. Which is a crazy situation, especially because Congress could appropriate more money to hire more judges to adjudicate the claims. Which brings us to the most recent essential inflection point around this, from my perspective, which is the bipartisan border security bill. And just to give people the context, after October 7th, Republicans were holding up aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. They were tied together and said, we will only pass these aid packages if they are tied to a standalone border security bill. So not the comprehensive immigration reform we just discussed, but just the border security piece. Democrats objected initially, but then basically relented. And Oklahoma Senator James Lankford, conservative, smart guy, worked with Democratic Senator Chris Murphy and Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema on what was ultimately described as the toughest by the Wall Street Journal as the toughest border security bill any president could get. And it had the support from the middle 60 in the Senate, which is what you need. And I'll briefly lay out some of the things and you can elucidate further, but it hired 1,500 more Border Patrol agents and incidentally was endorsed by the Border Patrol Union. It would have ended the policy known as catch and release. It would have enabled us to adjudicate those asylum claims in 4 months instead of 4 years. It also had set-asides for new technology at the border to stop the flow of fentanyl into our country, which is killing a generation of kids and young people in the United States. That was the subject of an earlier How to Fix It with Kamal Barwani, who lost his son. And further crackdown on human trafficking. That's about as close a win-win as you can get. And it had the support of Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, and it looked like it was going to passage. And then Donald Trump pulled the plug, and Republicans caved. And they put forward, you know, their own partisan bill, HR2, as an alternative. But talk about that bipartisan border security bill and how it failed and the cost of that kind of failure after so much work went into it.
Well, I think one of the most important parts of that bill was to, again, try to get control of the asylum system. Because you're absolutely right. Asylum was always meant to be asylum from a political, religious, or other kinds of government persecution in the home country that led people to come to the United States. And what most people don't understand, we talk about these asylum seekers as illegal immigrants. In fact, they are not illegal immigrants because under our current existing asylum law, you must step foot on U.S. ground in order to claim asylum. And that's what many of these people who cross the border do. They cross the border and turn themselves into a border agent, and that begins their long asylum process. But there is such a backlog, and we obviously cannot detain indefinitely everyone who's coming in that way. And so what ends up happening is their asylum process begins once they claim asylum, but it takes literally years. And by the time they get a hearing, they're no longer living in the same place they were. They may not even get notice of their hearing, which is why a lot of people don't show up to those asylum hearings. So we have to change that. We have to get asylum back to dealing with the kinds of cases that it was intended to deal with, and not simply be a way for people to get some foothold in the United States, however you know, difficult and however temporary it is. And that the bill would have done that. The bill would have overhauled the asylum process. It also would have increased the number of detention beds available, because some of the people that come in, there's no way we want to let them loose into the country. And by the way, one of the other difficulties is even when we release them into the country, they're not legally entitled to work for, I think it's 180 days, which means that, of course, they become burdens on the local communities. They came here to work in the first place. If they were allowed to work sooner legally, it would relieve some of the pressure on cities and states that are being inundated. So there were lots of things in that bill that I think most Americans would favor. But unfortunately, there was one American who did not favor it, and that was Donald Trump.
And then folks folded.
Yep.
And it was the closest to a win-win we could possibly get. Now, Republicans say that you know, Democrats should just back HR 2, but it seems to me the fundamental problem with their version is that it's designed to be a partisan play to the base bill as opposed to something that can garner bipartisan support, which as a practical matter is what you need unless one party has 60 votes in the Senate, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because if you don't have 60 votes, then you're going to have a filibuster and the bill will die. And it was really quite remarkable how quickly people turned tail. And we're talking about a bill that was worked on by James Lankford from Oklahoma, a Republican senator from Oklahoma. He's one of the most conservative senators in the U.S. Congress. And yet, at the end, even he wouldn't vote for his own bill. So it's really a tragedy.
Well, and that's because, you know, it was being set up to fail and become
right.
Sort of a primary risk, which is part of the problem, the polarization and increasingly sort of one-party states where the power goes to these closed partisan primaries. So how would you fix the asylum process? It seems like it's sort of fundamentally broken. We've created an incentive system for people to come here, cross the border illegally, claim asylum for economic reasons, but it's compounded by the fact that we've got chaos in countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua, and we haven't been working the way historically we did under the Good Neighbor Program to at least try to make sure there was a degree of stability in Central America. And I don't want to wax poetic about the past of U.S. involvement in Central America, because that would not fit the facts. But we've sort of taken our eye off that region, it seems to me, and that partly fuels the problem. But should there be a wait in Mexico thing? I mean, should people be able to show up at our border and claim asylum for economic reasons? Or are we setting up an incentive situation that creates the problem then that we're constantly trying to deal with?
Well, I think that the Biden administration tried to set up a program where, at the very least, you could begin the process before you got to the border. They created an app, and that app would allow people to, you know, get the process started, at least so that they weren't just, you know, showing up and then they would be given a time when they were, you know, to come through. And the Republicans hate that, too. They don't want to make it orderly. I've always thought that, you know, the process should not begin once you're in the United States, that there ought to be ways to do it in third countries or even in the home country. Mm-hmm. And we do need to tighten the definition of asylum. But while tightening the definition of asylum, we need to have other avenues available so people can work. And we had a real life experiment in how to fix this problem back when I was a child, actually. But I remember it. It was talked a lot about. And that was the Bracero program. And at the time that the Bracero program, you know, got into full swing, it started in 1942, but by 1952, we had over 1 million people crossing the border illegally into the United States. That would be the equivalent of about 2.5-3 million people coming now. So it's even more than we've seen at our highest rate of illegal crossings or border crossings without documentation. Hmm. Between the time that program started and over the next 2 years, that over 1 million illegal immigrants came down to less than 100,000. 90% of the illegal crossings
Wow.
stopped. And frankly, you know, not everyone who's coming wants to build a new life in the United States. Because our border security has gotten tighter, people come now with their whole family, because the chances are, if they get in and are able to stay, they'll never be able to go out again to see the families they left behind. The thing about the Bracero program was people knew they were coming temporarily, so many left their families behind. And it was a way for them to work in the United States and to send money home, and for them to be able to get the benefits of our labor market, but to be able to remain, it was largely Mexicans in this case, remain in Mexico. So I believe that one of the things we ought to be talking about is temporary work visas, because of that labor shortage, because we have jobs that Americans won't fill. We do have limited visas available through H-1B, H-2A, other avenues where people can, you know, get the right to work in the United States on a temporary basis. But except for the agricultural visas, which are very onerous on employers, they make it very difficult for employers. It's not a really robust system, and it doesn't really suit our market needs. So I think that a key to helping solve the immigration problem is to give people a chance to work on a temporary basis in the United States, understanding that they would not remain here forever. And there are lots of creative ways you could come up with to ensure return, you know, insisting that some of the money would remain in their home country, that they would, you know, not be able to access it until they returned. There are different ways I think one could come up with.
And how does E-Verify fit into all this from your perspective?
Well, interestingly, I've never been a huge fan of E-Verify in large part because I have some practical experience in this arena.
Explain what it is to folks, how it works.
Yeah, E-Verify is a government system that was set up to try to determine if you were eligible to work in the United States. The 1986 Immigration Reform Act that you referred to earlier, which was passed by President Reagan, the way in which they thought they would end illegal immigration is by basically turning employers into adjuncts of the Border Patrol. Employers now have to check every single person, no matter where you were born, how long your family has lived here, to determine that you're legally able. I mean, people who get new jobs know they have to sign forms, they have to produce documents, and that was supposed to stem the flow, and it didn't. Because as you might imagine, what it did is to create a new industry of identity theft and using stolen Social Security numbers so that people could work. Hmm. But the way it works is an employer that participates in E-Verify runs the Social Security number through the E-Verify system. And what that system does is come back and says, this is a legitimate Social Security number or it is not. But I can assure you there are probably some Linda Chavez's out there with my Social Security number working under that Social Security number. Hmm. My granddaughter just recently was a victim of identity theft, and she found out that there were two people in Texas working under her Social Security number.
Wow.
So it doesn't work very well. And Americans don't really want to be asked, you know, show your papers. It's not our tradition. I think there are probably better ways of doing this.
What do you see as the answer when people say, well, if we passed comprehensive immigration reform, how do we deal with the sometimes 11 million undocumented workers in the United States? And then conversely, I think the moral obligation to give the Dreamers some certainty because they've been in this sort of legal limbo, better than living entirely in the shadows. But what's your answer for the policy, how to fix that particular piece of the problem?
It's really disgraceful that we have not passed the Dreamers Act. And again, this was something that used to be bipartisan. I mean, you had Lindsey Graham out there championing it. You had Senator McCain championing it. You had all sorts of Republicans who believed in the Dreamers Act. And of course, Dreamers are people who are adults now, but who were brought to the United States by their parents when they were children, and the average age at which they were brought was 6 years old. So they're, you know, they can't, frankly, be held accountable for coming in their parents' arms into the United States illegally. And they are well integrated. When the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was put into place, you had to go through a very, I think, onerous process. You had to come up with all of your tax returns, all of your rent receipts. You had to open up your bank accounts. You had to prove that, you know, you were living in this country in a reasonable fashion. So we need to pass that. There are also people that we've let in this country from Afghanistan and from Ukraine that we need to satisfy their difficulties.
Absolutely.
And all of that would have been
done. The Afghan Adjustment Act should pass.
That would have been done in that bipartisan bill.
Yeah, that's a particular point of frustration and disgrace because that should be bipartisan. And there's so many areas where there is bipartisan support. That's part of the reason I want to emphasize that everyone actually knows how to fix this, right? There's disagreement on the details, but comprehensive immigration reform, we've discussed the practical imperative of the economic piece, the moral imperative for the Dreamers in particular, and the practical urgency around reforming and strengthening our border security and changing some of the incentives. On the piece for the folks who are currently here, that's the trickiest. Now, it is from my perspective, chilling to see ex-President Trump campaigning on mass deportations now and talking about armed mass deportations and, you know, raising the specter of, in his words, not mine, you know, detention camps, things like that. That's one of the things I think that should create a little moral clarity and moral urgency around this election. But as a practical matter, from your view on how to fix it, what's your preferred way of dealing with folks who are currently here undocumented? Is it sponsorship from existing companies, or that if indeed they've been working someplace for a long time? Is it get back to the back of the line? What's your vision of that piece of this particular puzzle?
There really is no line, by the way. I mean, people have this right. fantasy that there's this line and you get in the line and what's wrong with these people if they've jumped the line. There is no line. If you don't have an advanced degree to be able to get into the United States, there is no line. Your wait will be 20, 30, 40 years from some countries, and not just Mexico, by the way, but countries like China and India have incredibly long waits because we don't have enough places for people to come. We limit the number of immigrants that we admit legally. So I think the way to fix it is people should have to account for the fact that they crossed illegally. So I would assume that there will be some sort of administrative fee or fine. You will have to undergo security checks. You will have to show that you've paid your taxes. And by the way, most people who are working illegally in the United States pay their taxes. They not only have their Social Security taxes taken out by their employers, but they get employee identification numbers from the IRS and they file their taxes every year. And so, you know, I think that we would want to make sure that people paid any back taxes owed. And of course, if people have committed serious crimes since they've been here, those are not necessarily people we want to keep here.
Absolutely not.
So we could do this if we had the goodwill. Can I say just one thing about the cultural issue? We talk a lot about this in economic terms, and people are scared about the border. But one of the things that I think overwhelms a lot of Americans is that they encounter immigrants and they don't speak English. Mm-hmm. And the assumption is they don't want to learn English. They're never going to learn English. Your relatives, your ancestors came, I assume, from Italy?
Greece, actually.
Greece, okay. Greece, sorry.
No, it's fine.
Somehow. It's,
but the grandfather from Corfu, as it turns out, if you're from Corfu, you're part Italian because of the Venetians. So it's all one thing.
So they came here speaking Greek. And the chances are that at least the women who stayed at home didn't learn English in the first generation. It was really the kids who went to school and learned English. And by the third generation, you probably don't speak Greek fluently, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
true.
You know, that's the case with immigrants coming here who speak Spanish as well. People who've been here, born here, speak English, they go to school, they learn English, and by the third generation, most of them have lost their language. And I think there is a lot of cultural anxiety about that. Mm-hmm. People don't want the United States to suddenly, they don't want to feel that they're not at home in their own city, that they can't communicate with people.
Well, I think that there's also a sense we stopped celebrating the virtue of assimilation.
Right.
And that does lead to cultural anxiety and resentment. And the idea of, for me, assimilation is always a two-way street, right? Diversity is a strength, but you know, everybody sort of grows together. And but I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we don't talk about, you know, that piece of the puzzle, because I think it does make people think diversity means division. And it doesn't. It's not the story of our country anyway.
I think that's actually right. And that was the topic of my first book, Out of the Barrio, Toward a New Politics of Hispanic Assimilation, in which I showed that, in fact, Hispanics were doing just exactly what every other immigrant group to the United States had done. And that was they were assimilating economically, they were assimilating culturally, and they were learning English.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you for joining us. You've had such an extraordinary career and such a unique perspective on this. If folks want to go deeper, who are the thinkers, the think tanks, the legislative leaders people should look to who you think are actually putting a focus on how to fix this issue in a bipartisan way?
I think there's been a lot of terrific work done by the group that I'm affiliated with, the National Immigration Forum. We have a website with lots of material on it, including lots of thought pieces about what America's needs are for immigrants. The Brookings Institution has been heavily involved in this issue, and Pew Research is probably the single biggest data mine to be able to get a feeling of what's really going on. And so I'd check out any of those sites.
Linda Chavez, I want to thank you so much for joining us on How to Fix It, highlighting the fact that we can fix this, even what seems to be the most difficult and intractable of issues we can fix if only we reason together. Linda Chavez, great talking with you. I'm John Avlon. We'll be back next week with How to Fix It.